this is the way I explain it to my potential investors, that if, let's say I've got an 80-20 split, so my promote is 20%, what I'm really doing is I'm selling, it's just like Shark Tank, the TV show, I'm selling 80% of my business to outside investors. That's exactly what it is. So if you contribute 10% of the cash, you will have 10% of the piece of the company I'm selling. You know, so that's the way we do it. But again, that is what the promote is. It's kind of our premium for taking all the risk, all the liability, and all the headache on this one.
Welcome to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals who work with investors, buyers, and sellers of commercial real estate coast to coast. Whether you're an investor, broker, lender, property manager, attorney, or accountant, we're here to learn from the experts.
Welcome to Commercial Real Estate Pro Network CREPN Radio, episode number 208. Thanks for joining us. My name is Jader Gross. This is the podcast focused on commercial real estate investment strategies. Weekly, we have conversations with commercial real estate investors and professionals who provide their experience and insight to help you grow your real estate portfolio. Let's get into the show. Today, my guest is Bruce Peterson. Bruce is based in Austin, Texas, where he and his wife, Stephanie, have syndicated multiple real estate deals totaling over 1,100 units. He's also partnered on nearly 250 additional units, and he's been an investor since 2001. He and his wife were the multifamily owner of the year a couple times on the national level, and he's taught an intro to real estate investing class and also done a weekly TV spot in the Austin, Texas market. And I'm delighted to have him today. And in a little bit, we're going to talk with him about multifamily syndication. But first, I want to remind you, if you like the show, CREPN Radio, please let us know. You can like, share, and subscribe. And please leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Also, if you'd like to see how handsome our guests are, I encourage you to check out our YouTube channel, Commercial Real Estate Pro Network. With that, I want to welcome my guest, Bruce. Welcome to CREPN Radio.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm excited to have you here. We've been trying to set this up for a while, and it's finally we're able to do it. And before we get going, if you could just take a brief minute and share with the listeners a little bit about your background.
All right. So my background, I'm really a retail guy, right? So I was the guy that went to college out of high school because I was supposed to go to college. I had no business being in college. I was a horrible student. I'm a lifelong learner, right? It's that thing, but I just sucked at the whole structured learning, sit still in a school, and it just didn't work for me. So I dropped out of college, moved to Austin from Corpus Christi, where I grew up. And basically worked for other people, you know, until I hit 43 years old. I was 18 years in retail for big box stores, Best Buy, Bed Bath & Beyond, Home Depot, Lowe's. So that's what I did for 18 years. I thought I really, really liked it until I realized, this sucks. This is terrible. I'm 43 years old. I'm fat. I'm lonely. I was depressed. I mean, you're working 80 to 110 hour weeks. It kind of takes its toll on you emotionally and physically. And it did that to me. I was a Dave Ramsey guy back in that day. So I lived way below my means. I saved my money. I had an adequate amount of money, enough to walk away. So I just walked away at 43 years old and just started getting myself educated in real estate. Now, one thing you did mention is that I've been investing since 2001. That's my wife. I've been investing since 2012. That's when I bought my first 48-unit apartment complex. 300% return on that first one. But, you know, I always give the caveat to prospective or new investors with us. Don't expect that again, right? We bought that in 2012. The 2012-13-14 market hit, and we were in Austin. So, you know, we did well with it, but we also rode the coattails of the market. So, like you said, we've syndicated about 1,100 units now, a little over 1,100 units, over six different properties. We buy 200 to 400 units, properties that we syndicate. And really, it's the best thing I've ever done. It's the most fun and the most lucrative thing I've ever done by far.
No, I love hearing a little bit about your background there, and looking forward to digging into the your syndication model a little bit more. And based on that, I guess the first thing I'd love to hear a little bit about is syndication. And I've heard you speak before, and it seems like the word has a singular meaning when you say syndication, but within that, there's multiple different models that people can use to accumulate or attract investors, and then go into various properties, et cetera. And I think the thing that stuck out for me was there was a takeaway that I had when I heard you speak one time was that you kept it simple. And I was wondering if you could take a little time here and just share with us kind of, you know, from the premise of how you view syndication and your, you know, method of attracting investors and just what that looks like.
So my thought on syndication, I love syndication, right? So what I tell people that are trying to get into this, I've told people this for years now, go as big as you can afford to go, but do it safely. Don't take unnecessary risks. Don't be crazy about what you're doing. The bigger and bigger you go, the easier and easier your life becomes. Start in single family if you need to. Most people do, and there's nothing wrong with single family. It just doesn't have the payoff. It doesn't have the systems usually in place that you can run. So you got to get into commercial. And within commercial, I think syndicating multifamily has been the best thing that I found because it's the most rational. People have to have a place to live, right? So I love the syndication model. It allows a person to basically buy above their means, their personal financial means, right? So I'm going to put the deal together, myself and my wife. We're going to put the deal together. We're going to find the deal, close the deal, operate the deal. We have our own management company. So we're going to do all this stuff. But we bring other people into the business with us. So instead of investing my $300,000 to buy whatever I can afford to buy with that, well, I bring in 10, 20, 30 people all with $100,000. And now I can buy, you know, 5, 10, 20 times what I would have bought on my own. So it's a great way to leverage your investable dollars. It does come with headache, right? So you're dealing with a lot of people. We closed a 484 unit, 2-property portfolio a couple of years ago. Well, we had to raise $12 million. I've got 99 investors. That's not easy, right? That's a lot. You know, you talked about, you know, how do you deal with that? How do you manage it? We have a CRM that we use that we kind of run most everything through as far as keeping the investors up to date, how we bring people into our ecosystem also. So we do have a CRM now. But the syndication thing, like I said, I think it's a great model, but I think people can overcomplicate the hell out of this thing because not everybody's the way I'm going to refer to them in this one statement, right? So this is not broad brush, but the people that are overcomplicating it a lot of times, either they were taught that way and they know no different, or they're trying to grab every single dollar off the table they can. It's a bad idea. Horrible idea, in my opinion, right? It works for other people, and that's fine. I don't do waterfalls. I don't do a lot of the overly complicated things. Saw on a Facebook group post, I think it was yesterday, somebody was talking about a waterfall structure, right? So we share, like, this is going to get kind of into the weeds a little bit, but it's a 70-30 split. When you sell, if the IRR is below 15%, it's the 70-30. If it gets to 17, well, then it changes to a 60-40. If it goes above 19, then it changes to a 50-50. I'm like, all right, it's complicated. Is the 70-30 split is enough for me? I don't need to try to keep finding ways to pull dollars out of their pocket. Again, I'm not judging. I just think you overcomplicate things. And if I can present a deal to an investor that would return 100% of their money every single day, right? They would make millions and millions and millions of dollars, but I overcomplicate it. Their eyes are going to roll back in their heads. They're going to, you know, get glassy eyed, and it's not going to work. So no, I don't do waterfalls. Now I don't do preferred returns either. And that's a holdup for some people, and I totally get it. but I don't do it because I don't like the thought of tasking or taxing basically the partnership on day one of ownership with the 2-4% fee. I haven't done anything for them, right? For the partners. And immediately I got mine. You know, I'm buying $20 million assets. If I have a 2% asset acquisition fee, I hit the partnership for $400,000 the day we close. I don't feel comfortable with that. I don't like that thought. So we don't do acquisition fees. We don't do disposition fees. We don't do refinance fees. We don't do any of those fees. Again, I'm trying to keep it super simple. But the trade-off is I have to be compensated for our time. And so I've got to make up that income piece that I'm leaving on the table. So I don't offer a preferred return. We split. If I own 20% of the equity or 30% of the equity, every time a distribution comes out, I get my share of that distribution. So it works for us. And I've not had a lot of pushback. When I explain to people why I do it, most of the time they've been very, very understanding and they get it. They love the simplicity.
Right, right. No, I have talked to a number of different syndicators and the means and the ways that fees can be generated and the percentages and the, you know, the break points where there's more and all that, I was just going like, wow, that's, you know, I forget what's the name of the document, when you're raising capital that says basically, yeah, that everything could blow up and you could lose everything. You know, I mean, that seems overly complicated and more, I don't know. I just like the keep it simple. Here's the split. Everything comes in, goes out. This is what the split is on the back end when the sale, the whole nine yards. Are you collecting any kind of an asset management fee then? Or
yes, because we are the asset managers.
Okay.
So I perform that role. I am our asset manager. So yeah, okay. We do charge the asset management fee. We do get our promote. Our promote will be 80, it'll be an 80-20 split or a 70-30 split. And, you know, more than once I've done an 85-15 split. If the deal is structured or the deal is going to cost me enough or too much, it shouldn't say too much, but it depends on the metrics of the deal. If I need to bring it down to an 85-15 split to make it worthwhile for the investors, because really, look, I'm trying to sell an investment. I can make us all a lot of money, but if I can't get anybody interested in the deal, I can't make any of us any money, right? So I'll bring it down to 85-15 if I have to.
Okay. And I'm sorry, you said the promote. Can you explain what you mean by the promote?
It's basically the premium that the deal sponsor gets for running the deal. Some people ubiquitously will call it an override, but it's my premium because I'm taking all the risk for the most part, right? Everybody's putting their money at risk, right? But I'm taking the loan risk. I'm taking the business risk. I have a management company, so I have risk there. I'm the one dealing with the stress and of raising the capital and communicating with the investors. So for that, the deal sponsor or the syndicator will be compensated for the role they're playing. And that's called a promote. And that's all it is. So the 80-20 split, what that is saying that my promote is 20%. And so you can look at it this way too. This is the way I explain it to my potential investors that if, let's say I've got an 80-20 split, so my promote is 20%. What I'm really doing is I'm selling, it's just like Shark Tank, the TV show. I'm selling 80% of my business to right. outside investors. That's exactly what it is. So if you contribute 10% of the cash, you will have 10% of the piece of the company I'm selling. You know, so that's the way we do it. But again, that is what the promote is. It's kind of our premium for taking all the risk, all the liability, and all the headache, honestly.
Gotcha. Gotcha. I appreciate you explaining that. When you're attracting investors, do you also put your own money in on the limited partner side? Or
I've invested in every deal we've ever done. We try to do at least the minimum on every deal we do because our minimums are usually they're $50,000 to $100,000 per investor. They're usually 100, but we've made it a few exceptions over the years, and we've set it at 50. The one we just closed, 3 weeks ago, we raised $6.5 million, roughly 6.6, somewhere in that area. Our family put in $475,000. So we try to put a sizable amount in all deals. But what I also tell people, again, is there are reasons that your syndicator, your deal sponsor may put not a lot in, or sometimes not even any in, because I would only allow that if I'm a silent investor or a passive investor, if they have a proven track record, you know, like and trust that person. If they have never done this before and they're putting none of their own money into it, I would be really, really, really worried about that. But back to, you know, why a syndicator may not put money into their own deal. To sign for additional loans as I go forward in our career in this, I have to have a certain amount of liquidity and net worth, right? The net worth is what it is, but the liquidity, all of us are taught, for the most part, don't sit on money. It's dead money. Put it to work. Make money with your money. Well, we can't always do that, because then we just run out of money. And then now I can't sign another loan. I can't get another loan because I have no liquidity. So
yeah, I was going to say, unless you're talking to a bank about borrowing money, right?
Then Absolutely. So there are legitimate reasons why they may not put money into their own deals, but I only accept that from an experienced person with a proven track record.
No, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. Let me see here. I got some other quick. Oh, on your syndication model. So you, you find the property, you attract the investors, raise the capital. What's been your typical hold time for your investments?
Our deals are always structured with either a 4 to 7 or a 5 to 7 year hold period, because I want people to know that we pretend that's the expectation. These are illiquid investments, right? There's not a stock exchange that you can just go trade these things on. It's hard to get back out before we have our exit event. So with that being said, I'm going to look at the market every single year. Like, look, we plan on holding it, let's say, for 7 years. At the end of year two, we look at the market, say, oh, you know, and we've done this twice now. We think the market, there's a decent chance the market will correct in the next 12 to 24 months. I know, guys, we said we were going to hold this property for 7 years, 8 years, whatever. Well, we're at the end of 2 years. I think we need to sell, because the last thing I want to do is get into a bad situation and have to sell in an inopportune time. Right. So if my value has gone up because cap rates have come down and I've operated the property more profitably, I've driven more profit out of the property. So my value is up here. If the market corrects, I could see that value, even though the operation of the property hasn't changed, it may be still getting better. But because interest rates maybe start raising and the economy resets, we're going to start seeing value erode. So we'll sell early if we think we need to. My last property, we thought it was going to be 7 year hold. We sold it in December after 3 years. So again, the big thing there is we reassess it every single year.
Well, better to sell it a gain than to ride it all the way back down to a loss.
Exactly.
So no, that's good. Let me ask you about identifying a property. When you're, and have you primarily invested in Austin
or Central Texas?
Central Texas. Okay. I know of the markets. I've been to Texas a couple times, and just, you know, everything is big in Texas except the on ramps onto the freeway. And I'm kind of curious. I mean, you alluded to it a little bit earlier about how you recognize a lot of the success you've had is basically just the, you know, you were in the catching the wind of the market. But having said that, though, as you go forward, can you describe a little bit about what you look for when identifying a property, you know, with respect to a market, the vintage of property and the class of the asset?
Yeah. So if we're talking about market, I'm just looking for a dynamic market, something, a market where people are moving into it. I hope to see job growth, wage growth, not out of control crime. I don't like areas either that are too overly reliant on one industry or employer. And my example for this was, I think it was in 2009. Yeah, it was just this past January in December. The government shut down, right? So if I own something in a heavy government employed market, Well, not suddenly they have no paychecks. What are they going to do? People either were already or about to start getting kicked out of where they live, because a lot of people live on Section 8, whether I accept them in my property or I don't accept them in my property. It's just a fact of what's going on, right? People are on Section 8 housing assistance. Well, when the government shuts down, those checks aren't going out. The landlord can't really make an exception because I'll lose my property, right? So you're going to have a lot of people start getting kicked out. But so the big military towns where that's the only industry, I would stay out of those myself. And then, you know, vintage. I'm looking for 80s and 90s for the most part. I've got one property that I have right now, a 200 unit in Austin that was built in 1973. I try to stay out of the 70s. Definitely don't want the 60s and 50s. You're dealing with much, much older assets. And of course, when you get below older than 78, now you've got the lead paint, you've got asbestos, you've got different things to be concerned about. So I try to stay in the 80s and 90s. I'm looking for BNC properties. So working class, but for the most part, better working class, if you will. Don't have a lot of Section 8, don't have a lot of government housing type things going on in what we buy. I want to be in major markets too. I don't want to be in the secondary that, well, some of the big ones are considered secondary by Fannie. But I don't want to be in the small markets, even if they're up and coming, 50,000, 100,000 people. I can source enough good deals in a 2 to 3, 4 million person MSA that I just stay in Austin and San Antonio right now.
Got it. Got it. And population of San Antonio and Austin, what is the metro area there?
Last I saw, I hope I have this right. Austin is about 2.5 to 2.7 million and San Antonio is over 3.5 million. So two really major cities with lots of inventory, lots of job growth. So I love these two markets.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be pretty safe. Everything I've read and everything I see just continues to, sing the praises of Texas and the attraction. I don't know. It's just the is there a tax incentive for people to move there, or do you have any sense of why it is? It just easier to do business in Texas, or is it just a lot?
Yeah, we're always ranked one of the top, if not the very top, states in the nation to do business. Right, so. We court business very effectively. We pull from other cities and states that have the SALT, right? State and local tax, that thing. We don't have a state income tax, right? Everybody that tries to woo major employers, there are lots of tax rebates and incentives that are given out to bring people in. But, you know, there's a migration in the country and everybody's talking about it. Everybody's moving south. Everybody's tired of dealing with the cold and the brutal weather up there. So everybody's moving south. People in California are leaving California. Now they still have a ton of people. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with California, but a lot of them are moving out because the cost of living is skyrocketed. And I think their state tax is 13%. I have no state tax, right? So That's, I think, what's pulling most of the people in is our government approach to wooing big business.
Right, right. No, I know even here in Portland or in Oregon, we're 9% state tax, whereas you can go to Washington, they have no state tax. And I know it's an attractive opportunity for people that are getting ready to sell a business or something like that. They'll all of a sudden become, you know, Washington resident, then sell their business and enjoy the no tax on that from the state. Yeah. But definitely something that I see the attraction. I think Florida has the same thing, and I would think that as more investors from highly taxed areas are looking for places to go, and I would think just the job attraction just seems like such a positive way to attract industry, which is basically the first thing. Then you need workers, and then you need the housing to house the workers. I mean, it just makes a lot of sense there. So good. Good. Let me ask you this: in the number of properties that you've done, and do you look for value add? Are you doing value add, or is it more of just fully operational? Or,
well, so I will say they're all value add. But now, if you go by the traditional sense of that term, to me, value add really means, you know, occupancy is really not ideal. It's below 90%, sometimes in the 70s. You've got boarded up windows. You've got tons of deferred maintenance, lots of crime. You're going to come in and reposition, completely redo the whole property. And you're going to drive a lot of value out of that. Now, you won't have any cash flow while you're doing that because you're going to be running a loss. So I don't buy a lot of that stuff. There's just not much of that in the markets that I buy in right now. Most of it is just fully stabilized assets. But I, like I said, it's we're buying value-add properties because of our management company. Again, we're national award winners at this. We know how to go in and operate these things very, very effectively, very efficiently. And a lot of times we're buying from national, massive companies. You know, they're good at buying an asset undervalued, you know, putting lipstick on the pig and then putting it back out there and making a lot of money. But they don't really know how to operate them is what we're starting to find out. So we can come in behind some of these major players that aren't really good at operations. We can come in and tighten up the ship. There's all kinds of revenue streams we know to implement that a lot of these guys haven't done. So we can do that. Our marketing is a big deal. In the markets that we operate in, your occupancies are usually 92 to 93%. All of our properties consistently stay above 95%. So that's where we're driving our value is we're implementing new processes, procedures, revenue streams, tightening up the ship. Coming in and treating the residents with respect. And believe it or not, that's not always the case in this industry. So you treat them with respect, respond to their needs, let them know you're listening and that you truly do care. That's how we go about driving value out of our properties.
No, I appreciate you sharing that. You know, so often I hear about people buying, you know, distressed or just the deferred maintenance kind of thing and trying to go through and do a heavy lift. But it certainly seems to me that if you can identify those management opportunities and you don't have to do any heavy lifting or anything like that, it seems like that would be an easier fix. I don't know if you can you speak to any kind of the things that you find that you identify that, you know, you recognize what you could do differently?
Yeah. So I'm looking at, I could tell a lot by their financials, right? So look at their P&L, see what they have in their income buckets. A lot of times they don't have all the income items that they could have had. And if they do, they don't maximize it. So we do look for reserved parking. You know, usually we'll have 20 to 25% of a property set aside as reserved parking for anywhere from $15 to $45 for a reserved spot. Depending on is it an uncovered spot, is it a carported spot, or is it a garage? So we look for stuff like that. We provide renter's insurance for our residents. Now, they're free to get it from whoever they choose, but if they'd like, we can make it very, very simple for them. When they do actually sign the lease, they can get it right then. They can't move in without it. We just make it a lot easier, and we're usually very, very competitive there. So we're doing that. One big thing that we do also is, you know, go back to the community thing. We want people to know that we're listening to them, we hear, and we truly care about them. So we'll ask questions of our residents shortly after we take over. What is it that's missing here that you would like to see on this property? And, you know, some of those we will implement. And I bring that up because one of the things that came up one time is we did that and people said, hey, we're in Austin. It's 105 to 115 degrees during the summer. I would really like a place to park my car that's in the shade. I'm like, oh, we were hearing that for more than one person. I was like, ding, ding, ding. That's an easy one. Nobody in the neighborhood has covered parking. Well, so we built covered parking. That's got a 50% ROI, makes my property worth $500,000 to $1 million more. My residents are getting exactly what they asked me for. They're willing to pay for it. So we're making money, driving up value. They have been heard and listened to, and they actually got something they asked for. So that's it. Again, we just try to stay in tune. We don't have a cookie cutter model. Every property we have is run differently based on that tenant base and based on what they need. We had one that was extremely working class, very, very, very low income. Great people, but they struggle to make it day to day. So what we did there is when you put your kid in school every year, you know, all the way up to middle school, there is a $20 to $40 bill you have to put out to buy other school supplies. For these people, that is not doable. And some of these kids are going to school with nothing. And they start out behind the eight ball before classes even start because they don't have what they need to have. And so what we did on one of these properties is we provided all the school supplies, backpacks. We ordered pizza for the day. So we reached out to the residents, who's got kids, what age, what grade, all that stuff. And we reached out to their schools and said, what is the list that they need to bring to school this year? And we provided all of it at no charge. And we gave them lunch for the day because that's what they needed there. Not all of my properties need that. So we look to see what they need in that demographic.
I can only imagine the PR you got from that from the parents. You know, if they had any friends that lived in another community, or I mean, did you get some kind of a bounce from that, or do you have a waiting list for when you do things like that for people to move in? Or
oh yeah, absolutely. Because like you said, most people. I actually had some guy at a meetup about a year ago come up to me and say, "Hey, I know what you do. I've heard you talk before. Really impressed, but you know, you can make a lot of money being slumlords." Like, dude, look, get away from me. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, no, I'm serious. Walk away from me now. I said, that's such a horrible human thing to say about anybody. So yeah, just treat them with respect and you'll make more money. So yeah, we get lots of bumps. The biggest thing we get there is we get loyalty from our residents because they know we're loyal to them and we care about them. Industry average turnover in the apartment industry is about 50 to 55%. So if I have a 100 unit property, over the course of a year, about 50 to 55 of those units will become vacant because people are going to move out. Our average is 60 to 70%. That's huge. That's the most profitable thing we can do as a company, you know, an apartment complex, because there's a lot of expense incurred when you have to turn over a unit. So
right.
That's what
right.
We get. People don't want to leave because they know we're going to help them.
No, that's huge. And like you said, just that without the expense of a turn, I mean, the time you're down, the cost you have to incur to, you know, paint, carpet, whatever you got to do to the unit. That's great. That's great.
It's one of those hidden things that people don't always think about.
Yeah. You know, and I haven't heard you mention, I mean, it seems like the go-to things that I always hear people talk about is like rubs and you know, is one of the or, you know, rents are low. They'll raise the rents. They'll install a rubs program. Are those, do you guys use those, or is that kind of like a assumed thing, or?
Well, yeah, we do that on all of our properties, but that's the low hanging fruit for people with no imagination. Right.
Right.
That's exactly what it is. Everybody knows to do rubs. Everybody knows to raise their rents. So we go beyond that. And usually everything we buy really is already has rubs implemented, right? Because we're buying 100, 200, 300, 400 unit properties. These aren't mom and pop properties, you know, a 6 unit or a 12 or a 24 unit, you know, somebody mom and pop it in out of the back, you know, out of the bed of their pickup. So these guys, they might not be the best operators in the world always, but they're sophisticated enough. They know, yes, you always implement rubs. You set all that stuff up. So yeah, all of our stuff has that. Now, if we buy a property that doesn't have it, first of all, we got to make sure that submarket will support charging the residents back for their water usage. If nobody else in the neighborhood's doing it, you probably won't be able to get away with it either, because they'll just leave you and go to someplace where they're not doing that. But yeah, if the neighborhood supports it and they haven't currently been doing it, yeah, we'll always implement that. It's a
gotcha.
Huge money maker.
Gotcha. When we first started talking, you mentioned, you know, about the benefit of syndication, and it allows you to, you know, get into a lot larger properties. Did you ever consider going on your own, just, you know, doing what you could on your own, or was it always a matter of you recognize the value of scale?
I've always recognized the value of scale, because when I was being taught, I found somebody that was experienced and could walk me through the process. And I was like, hey, you know, I'll start with a 6 to 12 unit property. They're like, why in the hell would you ever do that? Well, because it's easier. She goes, no, it's harder. First of all, the smaller it is, the harder it is to run. She said, do you want to be the person running this property day to day? I was like, no, I'm retired. I don't want to buy myself a job. She goes, exactly. So go to a 40 unit and above. I'm like, okay, that's more than I can afford personally, first time out. Because 40 units and above is kind of a general rule of thumb that that's when you can start affording staff, right? I can afford part-time leasing person, and I can afford a part-time maintenance guy. So that was important for me to start at 40 units and above. So I did need to syndicate. My wife and I talk about doing our own things in time. But to be honest, this is probably a weird way to come about this, but, you know, I'm a people person. I like the camaraderie. I like the interaction with the investors. It can be difficult sometimes. We've got hundreds of investors spread across our different assets, but still, that's the fun part of it, right? You know, someday we'll buy our own stuff, but I really truly enjoy the syndication model. So I don't see us stopping that anytime soon.
No, if you're good at it and you've got a proven track record and people want to invest with you, I would think that'd be silly to stop that, unless the something's no longer working or something like that. That's good. Hey, Bruce, I'd like to shift gears here if we could. Before we started the call, I explained to you I'm an insurance broker by day, and risk management is one of the things that we constantly are dealing with. And there's essentially three strategies we look at for managing risk, and one is avoid the risk. Two would be minimize the risk, and then three would be transfer the risk, which is essentially what an insurance policy is. And I've been asking my guest, and I'd love to hear from you, if you could identify a biggest risk. And I'm not necessarily looking for an insurance-related risk, but I'd like to ask you, Bruce Peterson, I ask you, what is your biggest risk?
My biggest risk, it's the liability. We've had people die on the property. It's just, as you grow a business, you can't be the one doing all the jobs. You have to entrust people, and you hope that they're doing an effective job. You've interviewed them, you coach them, you mentor them in their job, and you can't be there with them all the time. So you just hope that they're doing the right thing and they're not getting you hung out to dry from a fair housing standpoint, from a discrimination standpoint, or that we have done something negligently that causes somebody to pass away. You know, the one death we've had, there was nothing we did wrong, absolutely nothing at all. That's probably the biggest risk is, you're dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people on a property. You buy a 200 unit property, average occupancy is probably 2 to 3 people, right? So if it's 3 people, I have a 200 unit property, that's 600 people right there that we are very involved in their lives on a daily basis. So we have a lot of responsibility. We take it very, very seriously. But as this is for me, you said Bruce Peterson, right? I'm a syndicator, but I own my own management company. So I have a lot more risk than a lot of people will have. I would guesstimate 80 to 90% of the people that do what I do, they want no part of management. They hire a third-party management company like us to come in and do it for them. So they won't have that risk. For those people, I would say this is kind of a macro. Be careful what you're doing, right? Don't get aggressive. Don't get anxious. Don't get impatient. I can't find a deal. Oh, this one works. No, it really doesn't work, but I got to get a deal. Don't do that. Don't buy the crap that's in an offering memorandum from a listing broker. Don't believe them when they tell you that your taxes are going to go up 3% year over year, because that's what everybody hears, right? You increase your expenses every year by an average of 3%. Taxes are different. And if you believe that, you could fall flat on your face. So don't be overly optimistic. Don't think the economy can't shift, because it's going to shift again. We all know it's going to shift. We don't know when. We think it's coming kind of soon, but we don't know for sure. So just be safe in what you're doing. Don't overextend yourself.
No, I love that. Want to ask you on your people in that, as far as the liability goes, knowing that you have your own management company, how do you manage that? Do you extra training? Is it? Can you speak to that a little bit?
How do I manage having? I mean, what do you mean?
Well, you mentioned that, you know, obviously you've got all the people coming and going from your property, and you mentioned the fact that, you know, you've got your employees and people that you train, and but, you know, you hope they'll do the job right. I was just kind of curious if you could speak to how, you know, your people, how you go about, you know, doing what you can to ensure that they're trained, or, I mean, is it regular staff meetings? Is it just constant awareness? Is there...
Right. So we do have regular, we usually have quarterly managers meetings where the regional managers, all the managers and myself will be in a room, and we'll just go over topics, things to watch out for, things that we want to change, things that we want to do differently, different campaigns that we have coming up that are going to be fun. And then the managers themselves are having weekly meetings with their staff, but we're a big believer in training. So we're a member of the local, state, and national apartment associations, and they have lots of good resources for training. So we're putting our guys into all those training classes that make sense for us. excuse me. A lot of our vendors will offer training too, like our insurance provider. He will come in and talk to us about risk management. You know, so we reach out to people like that. We've got a company that's going to come out to our properties probably the next week or two and talk about what do you call it? Like crime scene cleanup, that kind of thing. How to make sure you're safe in the event there is some kind of instance where there's blood. You know, how do you make sure that nobody gets injured, that we do things the right way until the police get there, the coroners get there, all that stuff. I got to make sure that they know how to handle these things and they don't just go charging into a bloody crime scene. Right? That's very, very, very dangerous. So we're always looking for ways to do that. And a lot of our vendors are more than happy to help us with that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. No, I appreciate you sharing that. And I think the, you know, from what I've seen, just that constant awareness and just, you know, trying to keep people on task or keep it top of mind seems to be one of the best strategies I've seen. And like I said, keep bringing other things in. And so that's good.
Yeah. It boils down to we're always investing in a piece of real estate as syndicators or real estate investors, but it goes so much further than that for me anyways, because I've got a management company. I have to invest in my people. You know, if I expect them to be top notch, I have to continually spend money to make sure they are up on the latest trends, the latest legal issues. Laws change all the time in rental real estate. So, you have to invest in yourself and your property, but also in your people. It's huge.
Thought occurred to me. Do you think that your approach to that, having had the retail experience you had for so many years, does that lend itself as far as the mindset? Was that common over in the retail?
Well, in some retail, yes, it's company by company. Some don't believe it at all, but most of them. But yeah, that's what it was. I've led people my whole life, right?
Gotcha.
I've been in a leadership role, leadership position. I don't mean to sound arrogant. It just comes second nature to me. I have an extremely high EQ or emotional intelligence. I can sense when something's wrong. I can tell if you really are a good fit. I know how to I've been interviewing people my whole life. I can read through the BS that you're giving me in an interview, right? So yeah, I got a lot of that. Some of it's innate, but I got a lot of it from my background in managing others through my retail experience. So yeah. And that's where a lot of people say, I can't do this real estate thing because I've never done it. Well, I had never done it either, but I had a skill set to your point or your question from another industry that conveyed very, very well. I'm just managing people again. That's all I'm doing. You know, right. I'm going to hire people that understand, that are experienced in their jobs. I just need to make sure they're doing their jobs.
No, that's great. I love to hear how that does, those prior skills, they transfer. And I would think it almost gives you an edge just having that public facing, you know, sense of things and how to have your people interact with the public would be a good thing. So
yeah, absolutely. It's helped me a lot.
Got it. Hey, Bruce, where can the listeners go if they'd like to learn more and or connect with you?
So you can start out with apartmentguy.com. So it's apt-guy.com. That's the website. Now, don't judge me on my website right now. It's kind of it's in process. We're revamping the whole thing. But, you know, there's a click. There's a button in the top right that says invest with Apartment Guy. If you want to invest, if you just want to connect with me, click there, fill out a short form. It's the best way to follow what's going on. Or Instagram is apt.guy. Those are the two best ways to keep in touch with me. I'm currently writing a book that should come out at the end of the year about syndications. And the website will keep you abreast of that, let you know when it's coming out and what to expect.
Awesome. Well, I wish you well with your book, and I can't say thanks enough. I've enjoyed talking with you and learned a lot, and hope we can do it again soon.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right. For our listeners, if you like this episode, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. Remember, the more you know, the more you grow. That's all we've got this week. Until next time, thanks for listening to Commercial Real Estate Pro Networks, CREPN. Radio.
You're listening to CREPN Radio for influential commercial real estate professionals. For more information on this or any of our guests, like us on Facebook, CREPN Radio.